Hi, this is Richard Gere. Did you know there are more Buddhists than Episcopalians in America today? That the Army now hires Buddhist ministers as chaplains. Chances are, whether you know it or not, you have Buddhist neighbors and friends. The following program on Buddhism in the United States weaves a fascinating tale of how this ancient philosophy has come to our shores and how it's affecting American art, literature, and life. I invite you to listen. Some are born Buddhists, the children of Buddhists from Japan and China. Some are born Christians and Jews and Muslims. Some are born in Tibet or Vietnam or Cambodia and have come to our shores because of social and political upheaval in their native lands. Others were born in Richmond, Dallas, or New York. There's been a Buddhist presence in America since at least the 1820s when Chinese shipwrights arrived in Gold Mountain, as they called America. The religion brought to the gold fields by the Chinese was a mixture of Taoism, Confucianism, and Buddhism. Reaction to the Chinese was often hostile, and the temples were viewed with suspicion. They were called Joss houses by the miners. Joss was a pidgin version of the Portuguese word for God, Deus.
Oh, workman dear, did you hear the news that's going round? Another China steamer has landed here in town. Today I read the papers, and it grieves my heart full sore to see upon the title page, oh, just 1,200 more. Oh, California's coming down, as you can plainly see. They're hiring all the Chinamen and discharging you and me. But strife will be in every town throughout the Pacific shore, and the cry of old and young shall be, oh, damn, 1,200 more.
Many temples were burned down by vigilantes, although some remained standing, often in disrepair or converted to other uses. One Joss house near Mount Shasta, California, however, is still a practicing temple. Today there are almost 3 million practicing Buddhists living in the United States, more Buddhists than Episcopalians. Worldwide, there are more than 500 million Buddhists. Buddhism got its first real foothold in North America in 1893 at the World Parliament of Religions, held at the World's Fair in Chicago. The gathering was a landmark event in world religious history. The convention marked the first ever encounter between the religions of the West and the East. Over 400 men and women representing 41 religious traditions addressed crowds of thousands for 17 days in a row. Among those representing Buddhism were Theosophist-trained Anagarika Dharmapala from Sri Lanka and Shaku Soyen from Japan.
Shaku Soyen attracted some interest and was invited back to the United States. And in the course of this, his student, the monk Nyogen Sensaki, visited San Francisco, where the Russell family was living. And instead of going back to Japan with his teacher, he remained in this country from 1905 until he died in 1957. He was told by his teacher not to begin teaching for 20 years. So he did not. Worked in various kinds of jobs, houseboy and cook and Japanese language teacher and so on.
Buddhist scholar Robert Aitken discovered Buddhism while imprisoned by the Japanese during World War II.
Then in 1925, he set up what he called a floating zendo in San Francisco, a floating Zen hall. And then in 1928, was able to establish a Zen center in one place. So this was the first Zen Buddhist center established in this country. Another teacher, Sasaki Sokeyan Roshi, established himself in New York very soon after that. And then a third person, of course, was Dr. D.T. Suzuki, who is also a disciple of Shakusai and Zenji, though Suzuki was lay, not a monk. So it was really these three personages who were responsible for establishing the Rinzai Zen tradition in the United States.
As teachers, ministers, scholars, and practitioners made their way to America, Buddha's gentle teachings of compassion and meditation continued to flow westward across Asia and the Pacific to Hawaii and then to the west coast of California, carried by successive migrations of Asian immigrants. But Buddhist ideas reached the Americas from the opposite direction, too, through Europe. As early as the 1700s, European intellectuals and adventurers began returning home from excursions to India and other colonies and outposts with tantalizing details of an exotic philosophy and art. By the time of Queen Victoria, a wave of Orientalism was sweeping both the salons of Europe and the drawing rooms of the United States. Mystics, merchants, missionaries plying the Eastern routes fed the curiosity of writers, artists, scholars, and trendsetters, and provided a steady stream of anecdote and information to the West. The rising interest in Eastern thought, the occult, and spiritualism prompted the founding of study groups and organizations dedicated to exploring Eastern philosophy, art, and religions. Christopher Reed is founder of Ordinary Dharma in Venice, California, where he teaches meditation and yoga.
The 19th century translators and editors and those who introduced Buddhism to the West, there was a natural process of selection that came in there because of the climate of the time and the desire for those, and I think of the, you know, the people who set up the Pali Text Society and the Russian and the German and the French translators in the mid to late 19th century. They were not interested in social conscience because that had been rammed down their throats, so to speak, as part of the general thrust of Christian European thinking. So they were very much drawn to the quietistic traditions, the mystical transcendent traditions, or rather those ways by which the Buddhist tradition could be looked at through that kind of perspective. And what that means is a very particular transmission, a very particular interpretation took place, which is only just now beginning to be addressed. We've kind of misinterpreted the very notion of enlightenment as something separate and personal and particular.
The writing that most popularized Buddhism in the West was a poem about the Buddha's life and teachings, written in 1879 by the British scholar Sir Edwin Arnold, called The Light of Asia. A year after the publication of The Light of Asia, the founders of the Theosophical Society, Madame Helena Blavatsky and her American colleague Colonel Alcott, announced they had embraced Buddhism and had been ordained in Sri Lanka. Colonel Alcott thus became the first American Buddhist. The Light of Asia sold almost 1 million copies in the United States. It was instrumental in shaping the philosophy and sensibilities of one of the major literary and spiritual movements in the New World, Transcendentalism.
Transcendentalism deals with illusion, as Buddhism does. Within the American tradition, there's a large tradition of the self who is one with the universe, not the personal self. The transcendental self, true self.
So from the East and the West, Buddhism arrived in the United States.
I would say there were two strands. One was through the intellectual life of the of the European intelligentsia. And so Henry David Thoreau, for example, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, the New England Transcendentalists, were very important in beginning to translate and to publish Buddhist texts in America.
Buddhist historian Rick Fields.
Thoreau translated the Lotus Sutra, or part of the Lotus Sutra, in the Dial, which was the famous magazine that Emerson published. Henry David Thoreau, who I kind of, even though he didn't, wouldn't necessarily call himself a Buddhist or anything, you know, other than Henry David Thoreau. just for me personally, at least, is kind of our first native American Buddhist practitioner. Walden, I think, is a profoundly Buddhist and also Taoist book. And he said, Thoreau said, there is an Orientalism in the most restless pioneer, and the farthest west is but the farthest east. It's one world and it's one circle. And the other strand that was going on at the same time was one that we, it's hard for us to find an exact name for it. Language itself has certain built-in biases, but let's call it for the moment in brackets or quotes, ethnic Buddhism. The Chinese, for example, while Thoreau was sitting in his little cabin in Walden in Concord, more or less around that same time, Chinese laborers were building the railroads here. And then a little later than that, Japanese workers were cutting sugarcane in Hawaii.
Buddhism made a stop in Hawaii on its way to the shores of California as workers and their ancestors moved eastward. The first Chinese immigrants arrived in the islands in the mid-1800s. They were followed by the Japanese, who were brought over to work in the sugarcane fields. Fear of reprisal prevented many of these early immigrants from practicing their Buddhism. But the efforts of a wealthy islander and Hawaiian queen Liliuokalani finally paved the way.
There was a remarkable Hawaiian woman named Mary Elizabeth Foster, who had a large home which is now Foster Botanical Gardens.
Ruth Tabra is a Jodo Shinshu Buddhist priest and author.
And she had become a Buddhist by having met a Buddhist priest who had been at the World's Conference of Religions in Chicago in 1893. He stopped in Hawaii for 5 hours. She met him through some theosophical friends, became a Buddhist. And so when Bishop Imamura, our first bishop, came in 1898, she was a great supporter. And when we built the new temple on Pali Highway, she gave him a bag of gold dust and the land to build a temple on. And at first, some of the Japanese immigrants were very hesitant about being Buddhist in a Christian community, because Hawaii's always been a very aggressive Christian mission territory. And they weren't quite sure whether it was quite all right to be a Buddhist here. So Mary Foster invited Queen Liliuokalani to come to our service in May, where Shinran's birthday is founded, our founder's birthday is observed, Gotane. And Mary Foster, Queen Liliuokalani, and a large contingent of Caucasian people came, and that broke the ice. After that, the Japanese immigrants came back to the temple and felt very much at home. If the Hawaiian queen came, why couldn't they?
Today, the Jodo Shinshu sect of Buddhism, also known as Pure Land, is firmly established on the islands, and Hawaii has more Buddhists per capita than any other state in the Union. One of the most encouraging recent developments in American Buddhism is the formation of ecumenical councils and organizations designed to bring together the various sects and traditions. This kind of cooperation is something that has not really happened anywhere in the world in 2,500 years of Buddhism. The alliances are difficult. Burmese Buddhists Richard and Diana Pa'u described the situation in Hawaii, their adopted home.
It's a real uphill fight because each individual Buddhist sect and subsect feel threatened when they are asked to become part of a whole. And some of these immigrants, of course, have the language barrier. They feel much more comfortable within their own group. We are trying to woo these people who are very shy of becoming, you know, absorbed by an association that encompasses so many other races. It's hard to get people together.
When I first came here, I discovered that in Hawaii there were three principal groups of Buddhists. Buddhists of Chinese, Japanese, and Korean origin, and I call them the Kama'aina. That's a Hawaiian word for locals. And then the others are the white American Buddhists. And of course, the third wave of Buddhists in Hawaii are the Asians from Southeast Asia, that is Thai, Vietnamese, Laotians, Cambodians, who are now coming more and more into American mainstream, you see. And the first thing I discovered was that, for example, during the Second World War, by the very nature of the situation here, there was no communication between the Japanese Buddhists and the other Buddhists. Although the Japanese Buddhists who were born and brought up in America are, as Americans and other immigrants, they are regarded as to be suspect, you see.
The majority of the Japanese sent to relocation camps during World War II were Buddhists. The suspicions of white Americans towards their Japanese neighbors was heightened in many cases when those neighbors adhered to alien creeds. In Hawaii, where most citizens of Japanese ancestry were not sent to camps, Buddhist priests were an exception. Virtually all were interned. Both in Hawaii and on the mainland, temples and schools were closed. Many were burned or vandalized. In Los Angeles, the largest Buddhist temple in the city was saved from a similar fate by Reverend Julius Goldwater, an ordained priest in the Jodo Shinshu tradition. As the only Caucasian member of the congregation, Reverend Goldwater was left in charge of things during the war. He spent his weekends driving to internment camps all over the West, bringing supplies and necessary religious materials, beads and altars, to the many Buddhists interned for the duration.
I had none of the rights. When I attended the meetings of all the reverends, the Caucasian reverends of the various departments of Christianity, without exception, they said, to give aid or comfort to the enemy is tantamount to being a traitor. And they behaved in that vein.
While the war disrupted the practice of Buddhism among the Japanese in the United States, it paradoxically exposed many Americans to its teachings. In fact, World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnamese War all served to further interest and involvement in Buddhism here at home. Throughout history, the upheaval of war has often provoked a questioning of values that ultimately opened channels for change.
The interest in Buddhism really began, I think, earnestly with our invasions of Asia, and many GIs over there having relationships and marrying Asian women. And I guess in their being exposed to all the suffering and turmoil of war, probably found some solace in the temples and the spirituality there, and so latched on to brought it back here.
Ryo Imamura is an 18th generation Buddhist priest.
And so you find a lot of this, always a resurgence after each war of interest. So this is why, especially in the late 40s, early 50s, after the war with Japan, and all, well, with whole of Asia, actually, that unfortunately, it's war is the motivator for most of the discoveries and inventions in our society.
The same dynamic took place to even a greater degree in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. Some GIs overseas in a predominantly Buddhist country were drawn to explore Eastern spirituality. They returned to a country more willing than ever to accept new ideas and philosophies.
I was a medic in Vietnam with the 25th Infantry. I had no Buddhist beliefs at that time, and in fact had no religious beliefs of any sort at that time. Being in the infantry, they used to take us to different forests and jungles via helicopters, and sometimes we would be up there flying far, far above the earth, and yet for as far as you could see, it was all bombed, burned, defoliated, poisoned. For as far as you can see, it was destroyed. I think there are other roads to Buddhism, but I saw so much suffering and really developed through that really inexplicable experience. I can't really talk that much about it, but I developed a social consciousness of really wanting to see the world get better, a consciousness I never had before. And although I think war is probably the last route to compassion, it's one of the ways.
The open-minded, ecstatic, freewheeling spiritual nature of the counterculture in the 1960s that embraced Buddhism and other spiritual disciplines with such fervor was a far cry from the cool and analytical Beat Generation that adopted Zen Buddhism a decade earlier. Poet Diane de Prima.
Before I was actually, or before I think most of us, or any of us, were actually practicing Buddhism, still it was here in the form of ideas in the 50s. And it began as an influence in my work in the mid-50s because of the essays of D.T. Suzuki and the essays in Zen Buddhism, the three-part series, and the fact that that stuff had already been an influence on Cage, John Cage, and Merce Cunningham, and other people in the New York milieu that was just the generation before mine. So it filtered, trickled down to being ideas in the air, and a lot of it had to do with, like, following the natural mind, not spending a lot of, because it was Zen, there was a sense of not, a lot of not paying attention to rules of how things should be in the arts, but going more with a spontaneous impulse. And I think that for all of us, that spilled over into the work at a very, very early point. All of us in New York at that time that were writing or painting, or even people who would never avowedly say they were Buddhist in any way.
D.T. Suzuki is known as the man who brought Zen to the West. His first visit to the United States was in 1897, and he spent the rest of his 96 years writing and lecturing about Buddhism around the world.
He was about the first one that came when we all became aware of the depth of Buddhism. Until then, we took it for granted that we were Buddhists, but we didn't really inquire so much. But when we started here, they started to have study classes. And at the beginning, you know, you get all mixed up. I mean, it's just too much, you know, 84,000. So here he came and gave simple, direct answers for us that, you know, it's really made so much sense. And so he became a real, almost a rave in America for a while.
Prior to the 60s, Zen equaled Buddhism for most Americans. American Buddhists had little contact with the Japanese-dominated sects like Jodo Shinshu, also known as the Buddhist Churches of America. For many years, most American Zen Buddhists were gathered on opposite coasts around the few Asian masters who had decided to teach American students. By the 1930s, Zen masters Senzaki in California and Sokayan in New York were giving ongoing instruction to serious students. In time, eager to learn about all aspects of this new philosophy, American Zen students began to seek out teachers from other disciplines. Ryo Imamura's father was the head priest of the Jodo Shinshu Buddhist Church in Berkeley, California. Many young poets and writers who were soon to become spokespeople for the Beat Generation began attending weekly study groups at the church.
In the 50s, there was a certain innocence of Americans. They really didn't know or understand Buddhism. And so there was a lot of questions from so-called beatnik artists who were, and also ex-GIs towards Asian Buddhists here. They were discovered, and there were a lot of meetings. I think my father's temple here in Berkeley was a primary meeting place for Westerners who were just beginning to become interested in Buddhism and for Asian Buddhists. And it was on equal ground because, actually, the Americans were even felt humbled by that experience, so they listened very intently. But I think very quickly, and it's evolved a full scale now, is that Americans acquired and began to understand Buddhism, of course, on their own terms.
Jane Imamura, Ryo's mother, helped her husband run the Berkeley Church.
They were all students, Gary Snyder, you know, and Jack Kerouac. He used to come too. There's Alan Watts. He was the one that came first. A lot of these boys, like Will Peterson and Gary Snyder, Glenn Grosjean, so many of them went to Japan and entered the Zen monastery, you see, and they studied there. And they weren't famous at that time, but now, you know, they're really well known. And then, of course, Dr. Suzuki came. And he is English, you know, he was writing good books. And so we had these students, and when Dr. Suzuki spoke in Fresno, we took two carloads from here to listen. And we had that little place, we had 200 or 250 anyway people. And many of them were not Japanese, you know.
I once was a Baptist, and on each Sunday morn, I'd be in church praying, as sure as you're born. We'd sing there like angels, in that good harmony. But sin and salvation are no longer for me. And now I'm a Buddhist, I chant my mantra each day. But I miss that hymn singing in the good gospel way. So we'll sing to old Buddha,
Buddha,
Buddha, and the wonders of Zen. We'll meet in Nirvana, yes, we'll be there then.
A generation later, in 1959, another Suzuki, Shunryu Suzuki, arrived in San Francisco to take over the leadership of a Japanese-American Buddhist temple. He spoke English fairly well and soon began attracting American students, inviting them to join him at 5:30 every morning for a sitting meditation. Kenji Muro is a Japanese author.
They asked Suzuki Roshi not to do that, because this is our temple, this is Buddhism for us. Beatnik, you know, wears some strange, you know, clothes and barefoot. So Suzuki Roshi kind of forced to choose to teach Buddhism to Japanese or foreigners. And he decided to establish Zen Center.
Suzuki believed that his American students' relative ignorance of Buddhist theory and Zen culture was an advantage. that it gave students a fresh, positive way of approaching Buddhism, free of cultural baggage. The San Francisco Zen Center grew to be one of the largest American Zen communities in the country. In 1966, the center opened a retreat at Tassajara Hot Springs in rural California. It was the first true American Buddhist monastery.